It's really a pleasure to welcome Dr. Hillier Jason and Dr. Jane Westberg to our to McGill and to our rounds this afternoon. As I don't know how many of you actually read the bios that we circulate ahead of time, but there will not be a quiz. But it's a pleasure to tell you that Hillier Jason, also known as Hill, is actually a native Montrealer. And in the various emails that we exchanged, there was clearly a love of Montreal and a desire to come back to his hometown that was evident. I would also say that you were probably most specific about the individuals that you wanted me to invite to Med-Ed Rounds, and I'm delighted to see that those we invited actually came. So thank you to all of you. Hill did his undergraduate degree here at McGill, then traveled to probably more American universities than I will get right in this short introduction. And I would say has been a pioneer in the area of medical education and faculty development for many of us. He has consulted to schools across the universe. He has been to, I think it was approximately 36 different countries as a consultant on medical education. And I would also say has had a personal influence on me in terms of my development in faculty development and medical education. And as Hill and Jane may not know, I think almost every article I have written on faculty development or every presentation I have given always says the following, which is coming out in a recent, in an upcoming chapter. As Jason and Westberg state, and it's lovely to have you both in the room. For years I quoted you that without knowing who you were. The one task that is distinctively related to being a faculty member is teaching. All other tasks can be pursued in other settings, and yet paradoxically the central responsibility of faculty members is typically the one for which they are least prepared. I believe you wrote that in the early 80s. Unfortunately, it's equally true in 2010, though we have made significant progress. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce all of you to Dr. Hill Jason, and here's to a wonderful presentation. Thank you, Hill.
Thanks so much, Ivana. Thank you all for being here. It's wonderful to see familiar faces from my long past. Jane and I had the thrill yesterday of visiting some of the classrooms I sat in as a student 60 years ago. So it was quite a nostalgic visit and a wonderful chance to be among you and to learn some of the really exciting things that have been happening at this university and certainly in the medical faculty since the days that I was here. And as I travel around the world, as I seem to do, there are wonderful, positive developments happening in many places, but I'm afraid I have to assert that we need reform in the way medical education is done, even more now than ever before. And I'd like to cite three reasons why that is, and one of them simply is that those of us who care deeply about how future health professionals are prepared like to think of ourselves as scientists, and scientists are never satisfied about their conclusions. There are always new questions to be asked, and there are always new answers to be found, so we have to continue evolving our understanding of the teaching learning process. But there are two other reasons why we have to be seriously re-examining health professions education generally and medical education particularly, which is what I know best. Because of one, I think it can be fairly asserted that the cohort of students arriving now in medical schools is more different from their predecessors than any cohort was different from their predecessors ever before. And we won't be able to linger on that today because that's a topic of another considerable exploration, but a big part of it is the transformation of the world from being an analog-based world to being a digitally-based world. The repercussions are profound in the extreme, and I don't think they're understood adequately yet. And forgive me, I have to explain that I'm taking a fairly high dose of antihistamine, and anybody who's a clinician or has other afflictions that make them take antihistamines know that your mouth gets very dry and very sticky very quickly. So forgive me for drinking alone, but I'll be doing a lot of that. The analog-based life that most of us have led essentially confers on us the status of being digital immigrants, while our students who are arriving are digital natives. And it makes for a different relationship to the world of information and a different relationship between them, among each other. It makes for the possibilities in their educational experience something that they're doing every day in their lives, and that is collaborating horizontally. They're participating in user-generated information. They're participating in crowdsourcing. They're using Wikipedia and other resources that are part of this new digital world, and it's profoundly different from the world we grew up in, which was a vertical world, a world of authorities declaring to those below, those students and others, who they were providing their information and understandings to. And the difference between a vertical world and a horizontal world are profound, and that's a subject for another time. Today, we're going to look at the third reason why medical education and education generally, in my view, needs to be seriously reexamined, and that is because of the amazing explosion that's going on right now in brain science. We have known a lot about teaching and learning for a lot of years. There's been some very good research done. At least in medicine, a great deal of that research and the implications of that research for medical teaching has been dismissed by many of our colleagues. It's certainly not taken very seriously, often with the explanation that I've received an uncountable number of times that, that education research, that psychology research, that's soft stuff. It's not real research like we biologists and hard scientists do. Well, that was a rationalization and excuse, but it was powerful, and it kept a lot of change that was necessary from happening. But now the playing field is entirely different. The information and understandings we're getting from brain science is the hardest of hard science. We now have confirmations at the cellular and at the molecular level of what the human brain does as it's learning or not learning. And as I've started to have to tell my colleagues in medicine, presuming to be an educator without understanding how the human brain learns is entirely analogous to presuming to be a surgeon and disdaining human anatomy. If you don't pay attention to the foundation on which you are presuming to have influence, then you can't do your job properly or even safely. And I will try in a short time to coalesce in this one quick tour of brain science some of the most important findings and implications as I see them for what we do as teachers. And in the process, I'm going to have the opportunity to make two Montreal connections. The first one is an example of our brains not having been taken as seriously over time as they have deserved to be. And as I've been told, may not be entirely true, but many of us live with the assumption that professional hockey got its start in Montreal in the 1870s. And as some of you may be interested to know, if you don't already, within the first year of professional hockey getting underway, a particular appliance was invented, the so-called athletic cup, and the underwear that holds it to protect the men who play hockey. And in the 1870s, virtually every hockey player in professional hockey was wearing an athletic cup. it wasn't until the 1970s that they started routinely wearing helmets. It took them 100 years to decide that their brains were also important. I offer that as a metaphor for some of what we've done as teachers. And we have to start taking the brain very seriously. And I will make another Montreal allusion in a few minutes. But let's just begin this instrument we all carry around in our skulls, roughly 3 pounds, 1.4 kilos, is an amazing instrument that we're just coming to have real insight into its operation. That's more neurons than there are stars in our Milky Way. The potential is awesome, and we've seen examples of that. And I will talk a little about its potential, but I'm going to start by exposing us to something other than potential, but rather to limitation. Please put up your hand if you think you've got that number memorized by having looked at it just now or could have it in another few seconds. Anybody able to do that? You could do that. That's amazing. Yes? That's great. A very small subset of the population of the Earth can memorize a 12-digit number quickly like that. Our brains aren't wired to do that. The great majority of us can only handle about half those numbers, maybe slightly more, but not 12. But a subset of people can do that. That's part of the differences, the diversity that I will expand on. But let's take that number and look at it in more detail. Anybody who pays any attention to world history and cares about when Europeans began to pay attention to the existence of North America knows that Columbus sailed and arrived here in 1492. And that was buried in that number. Another number that's buried in there was the end of the Second World War and the year in which the first and only atomic weapons were used in this world. And finally, if you're alive and well, you probably know that's this year. Those were all buried in there, and I offer this as a little bit of a metaphor for one of the things we're now understanding about teaching and learning, and that is what some writers are starting to call the curse of knowledge. Others of us have for years referred to it as the consequences of a phrase, unconsciously competent, the notion that as people become more expert and become more embedded in and more deeply knowledgeable about their own area of work, they lose track of their own cognitive history and they lose the ability to tune in on what others need who are just beginning. And the curse of knowledge is now a well-documented phenomenon of the insensitivity of teachers to the needs of beginners or of just other people. And it's basically, it's the separation of what one person regards as meaning and another person regards as nonsense. A number that, that for many of us would have been nonsense to begin with and impossible to remember quickly, can have meaning embedded in it. And as a teacher, if we see that meaning and don't help make it clear, we're failing to communicate in a significant way. And just to clarify my earlier statement that we've known a lot about good teaching and learning for a long time, but it hasn't been adopted, this isn't the finding of brain research. This is the finding of presented in a monograph published by Hermann Ebbinghaus in 1885, not 1985, 1885, in which the whole notion of the difficulty of the human brain handling nonsense was very clearly explicated and subsequently systematically ignored by most people who do teaching. Excuse me. I want to take us a little further into the teaching-learning process in terms of the human brain's capacity. This is 9-month-old Colin. He and his parents have just arrived their first day in a new city because of a new job responsibility. The furniture has just been unpacked and put in place, and Colin's parents were concerned that with the unfamiliarity, he might get his fingers into some of the electronics, so they took some of the large boxes and put them in his way to keep him from getting his fingers into the electronics and told him not to go there. He was 9 months old. They turned around for a minute, turned back, and there he was, and they happened to have a camera and grabbed this wonderfully expressive photo that tells us something extremely important about childhood, and that is the undamaged human brain is an amazing learning machine. As the distinguished physicist Brian Greene has tried to tell us, we're all born as little scientists. We have the characteristics that make for good science. This is what children bring with them, and what unfortunate child-raising traditions and unfortunate early childhood education knocks out of them. The most common word in young people's language at a certain age is the word why. The foundation word of good science and the foundation word of good learning, together with words like what and how and some others, but that summarizes it. And yet, so many parents, not realizing the consequences of their actions, get asked why or what or how so many times that they start responding, oh, come on, you've asked me that 150 times, enough already, I'm tired. And slowly, gradually, too many citizens of this world stop asking questions. And as I will come back to, we now understand even more profoundly than we used to that asking questions is the foundation not just for good science, but for good learning and good personal development. And I'm going to take you to another piece of childhood just for a moment and ask you if you'd raise your hand if you think you can make a somewhat tentative guess as to which of those four chocolate bars this young boy prefers out of the four. Raise your hand if you think you know which one. Okay, not all of you, but most of you, and I'm guessing that some of you are tentative about raising your hand because you're a product of our school system, which makes it risky to stick your neck out for fear of criticism, for making a mistake, for all the things that our school systems do to people. And unfortunately, we tend not to take chances in class because taking a chance was risky in a lot of our schooling. Well, I'm glad most of you put up your hands because young children can answer this question accurately. We are born as little mind readers. We start very early being able to detect what Daniel Goleman has helped teach us to understand as emotional intelligence. We can see in people's facial expressions, their body language, something about what they're feeling and thinking. This is part of our makeup. It's natural to us. And yet, as some of you know, I've done a lot of work over the years observing medical teachers in action, what they actually do with students. And with great sadness, I've had to conclude that a large, worrisome proportion of medical teachers either don't understand or don't care or have lost the ability to pay attention to emotional information. They are not responsive appropriately to their students' communicated feelings and worries and concerns. They will say things that are hurtful without realizing they're doing so. And whatever emotional intelligence they were born with seems to have being set aside or squelched or maybe lost. So I'm going to take us back now to another Montreal story. Might any of you actually recognize this man? Would that be a familiar photo to anybody? It would be surprising if it were, but I'm curious. How about how he was known for 55 years, Patient HM? Does that mean anything to anybody in the room? Okay, you've heard of Patient HM. Big Montreal connection. Maybe Some of you know about it. I'd like to linger on it for a minute. We now know his name. He died in December of 2008. He left no family, and those responsible for his care decided it was okay to release to the world the name and identity of the man who was the most studied human being in the history of neuroscience and one of the most studied human beings in the history of medicine. He died at age 82, just a little while ago, and his story brings a human face, I think, to our understanding the human brain. When he was 10 years old, he began to develop a seizure disorder. It slowly got worse and worse. By the time he was 27 in 1953, he had lost his ability to function in the world. His seizures were so frequent and severe that he couldn't function. Well, the Montreal connection is that Wilder Penfield at the Montreal Neurological had pioneered the treatment of intractable seizure disorder, as it would be known, by actually identifying as best they could in those days with the available technology the origination site in the brain and literally going in and ablating and removing that part of the brain and in many cases providing substantial relief or even recovery from these severe seizure disorders. Well, it happened that in Hartford, Connecticut, where Henry and his parents lived, there was a neurosurgeon who was now starting to do that procedure, and he agreed that Henry would be a good candidate, and the family was desperate. They had him undergo the following procedure. They had identified that it was the medial temporal lobes, right down in the center lower part of the brain, in here, that were the sources of these incredibly frequent seizures. And buried between them, way down here, is a small part of the brain that even then was called the hippocampus, but almost nobody really understood what it did or whether it was really important. So out it came along with the medial temporal lobes. And biologically, Henry seemed to recover decently, and he woke up and was friendly like he had always been. But something terrible began to be noticed. The nurses would come into his room, he'd greet them, they'd talk for a few minutes, the nurses would introduce themselves, they'd walk out of the room for a few minutes, come back in, and Henry would greet them as if he had never seen them before. And a variety of incidents like this made it very clear that this 27-year-old man was no longer laying down new memories in his brain with what had happened. Well, his neurosurgeon called Dr. Penfield, and Dr. Penfield, over the phone, as far as I remember, really decided there was not much that could be done any longer. This was it. But he said he had a young psychologist by the name of Brenda Milner who had started to work with him. She was working on her PhD and had started to study some of his patients in Montreal, and Brenda, who was a student here at McGill, agreed to go down to Hartford and begin to get to know Henry and see what she could learn that might be constructive. And that began one of the great science stories of our era, of one of the great stories of medical investigation and the confirmation that this wonderful woman who happily is still alive and well, as I understand it, never lost her little scientist in her because she continued to study Henry for 50 years. And she has made enormous contributions to our understanding of the learning brain. And I will just give you a little snippet of it to whet your appetite for maybe more. She asked Henry to engage in a variety of different exercises, and this represents one of them. In addition to confirming that he was no longer laying down verbal memories, she wanted to see how he was doing with performance memories. So this was one of the tasks she used. She asked him to take a pencil, start at the top, and draw with his pencil inside the white line with one big condition. He couldn't see his hand or the paper directly. He could only see it through a mirror. And unless you're an experienced dentist, that's a very difficult task to do. And Henry was able to say, hey, that looks very difficult. I don't think I could do very well. She said, fine, go ahead, give it a try. And sure enough, he didn't do very well. But Brenda, being a good scientist, didn't give up. She just kept asking him gently to try it over and over again over time. And he, every time, looked at it and said, hey, I've never seen that before. It looks difficult. And she said, yes, but give it a try. And wonder of wonders, he kept getting better and better at the task. Something different was happening in his brain from remembering verbal information. And this opened up a huge, important door for us. She had helped us understand that there are more than one kinds of memory. We had a very simplistic idea of how the brain remembers, but she had pointed out there was short-term memory, which he still had. He could remember a name for a half a minute or a minute, and he could remember numbers for longer if he used certain tricks by repeating them over and over again or doing calculations around those numbers. He could keep it going for maybe up to 10 minutes, but he couldn't get to the next stage. He couldn't make it long-term if it was verbal information, and that helped us understand that without the hippocampus, this process didn't happen. But something else was happening, because there was a second form of long-term memory he was acquiring. He was learning a procedure, and declarative memory and procedural memory are a couple of the jargon terms that are now used if you read this literature. You have to recognize that psychologists are almost as good as physicians are at inventing jargon. So this is some jargon from psychology that's helpful because it defines what we're dealing with. But we have to understand it further, so we take it another step further, and we have to realize, of course, there's input has to come from somewhere, and we assumed initially that it was all sensory input, and where it went after that depended on the kind of input it was. So take away the defect just in the normal brain, it seems that some of it went to working memory for verbal or declarative memory. Something else went to procedural memory, and we came to respect the fact that there's an acquisition phase to memory, the time where things come in, and then there's a retention phase, and that phase has steps to it, and this simplifies it into two clear steps and two clear pathways. It's, of course, more complex than that, but I think this is helpful in understanding a lot of what happens. But there's more to it, as it turns out. There's also a retrieval phase. It doesn't do us much good to lay something down if we can't get it back on demand. And this is the week in which students all over McGill are facing the retrieval challenge. It's examination week. And one of the things starting to focus on that helped us understand is that the input phase is not just from our senses. There's another very important source of input, and that is our own memories. The act of remembering something turns out to be an important thing that we then remember. And if we've made a mistake somewhere in this cycle and what we've remembered is different from what actually happened, we still remember what we remembered, that we retrieved, and that has profound implications, which I'll get to next. But first, just a little bit of glimpse of the approximate times of these phases of memory. The sensory input happens very fast. It's measured usually in milliseconds, maybe up to a tenth or a quarter of a second. And that's a long time for the brain, as it turns out. And we now know and understand some optical illusions and other errors the brain makes because of that time lag. We won't dwell on that because it's not usually very important to us educationally. Short-term working memory doesn't give us a lot to work with, and is the reason that most of us can't handle 12-digit numbers. It's too much to squeeze into that short period of time. If we are successful in laying it down as long-term declarative memory, the things that most colleges and universities dwell on most, namely verbal information, it's not there to stay. It has to be used and reinforced, and I will explain that further in a moment. But for looking at the retrieval process first, it's not what we have naively assumed for many years. We have naively theorized that the brain is kind of like a filing cabinet. You see an experience happen, you see information on paper, you read a book, and it kind of gets filed away somewhere in your filing cabinet. And when you're ready, you pull it out again like you pull a piece of paper out of a file in a filing cabinet. All wrong. It turns out that that's not the way it happens. As you, I assume many of you know, we have incredible instrumentation now that enables us to literally witness memories being laid down and retrieved. We can actually see it happen in human brains. And it turns out that retention is associative. And what that means is that at the molecular level, we are learning something many of us suspected from other kinds of research, that memories have to log on to something. They have to click into place according to what's already there. And the more that's already there, the more is available for attaching these new memories. But it gets a little more complicated than that. We now understand that the human brain is constantly at work laying down these pathways that are not only unique to each person, but they are amazing in their complexity. Even if all you're trying to remember is a simple diagram with a vertical line and a horizontal line, you remember that diagram, except the horizontal line goes into one place in your brain and the vertical line goes to a different place in your brain, which leads us to what's necessary as step two, which is retrievals aren't the pulling out of an unchanged piece of paper with information on it, like in a filing cabinet. They are reconstructions. So the managerial system of where things got put away and how they come out again is a vital part of a fully functioning, healthy brain. And that leads to all kinds of complexities. And as you may guess, if you aren't familiar with this already, is that it leads to the potential for a good deal of error in this complex system. And one of the places it had most dramatically had a consequence are the distortions and manipulations that we now understand in our criminal justice systems. Elizabeth Loftus, then a professor at the University of Washington, began quite a while ago studying the gold standard of the criminal justice system, the eyewitness testimony. And her work, now supported by many others, has virtually caused the elimination of the eyewitness testimony in a great many situations because of its unreliability. And that's thrown many courts into disarray. And, of course, the search is on for alternatives and supplements. It's not the central part of our point. But the issue is, these are the kinds of understandings we're now beginning to get. So let's take it to another stage. I'm going to enlist the help of a magician with a little parlor trick. And if you know this trick, don't reveal it to your neighbors because it'll spoil their fun. Just for fun, follow his instructions. This will only take 2 minutes for the whole thing. But follow his instructions and see how you come out on this little trick that David Copperfield is going to do. No. Unfortunately, the angle of the room makes it very difficult for some of you to see things as clearly as possible. Put up your hand if your card is gone. Great, thank you. leave it up if you understand how it happened, what he did. One, two, did you know how it was done before I showed it to you? You did, you didn't. You want to explain it? How did it happen? Pardon? You use the same trick, so we won't ask you. Pardon? Oh, in a learning lecture. Good for you. Thank you. You figured it out. How was it done?
I think what he did was just swap really similar cards. So they were still phase cards, but they were the off-color suitors.
That's exactly the point. What he has done is actually the essence of a great deal of what we call magic. He counted on our difficulty focusing on more than one thing at a time. And by assigning us to pick a card, he's counting us on us to concentrate on that one card and not pay enough attention to the other five cards in the collection. So when he brings back five cards, our instinct is to think it's the five cards we didn't choose. They are all new cards. All the cards are removed. So you can't have picked a card that he wouldn't have known about because they're all gone, not just yours. But I bring this to your attention because I will come back right now to the incredible importance of focus in learning and the brain's role in that. So let's turn to a little more in-depth look at this process. These are the three phases that I've alluded to already. And as I've alluded, things have to come in from somewhere. It's mostly our senses, but also our thoughts are extremely important input for human learning and human memory. And then comes focus as a topic. It's a simultaneous thing. Input doesn't happen if we're not focused on it, if we're not perceiving and attending to something. It has no way of entering our consciousness and therefore our brains. And as you think of your own teaching, your own learning, think of those things that support or interfere with focus, because those can be powerfully important in determining the effectiveness of an educational experience. But let's keep going. The next step has not been given, I think, as much attention in education, certainly in medical education, as it probably deserves. You probably are all familiar with the saying that we get out of a learning experience what we bring to it. And that's not often explained or fully elaborated. And what it now means at the cellular level, we are understanding, is that what exists in our brain causes us to perceive new experiences, new information, new people, whatever, in our own way through our own set of filters. And we essentially infer meaning in almost everything we perceive, and that shapes how it gets laid down in these unique tracks in our brain. And again, while we're learning an enormous amount, literally by the day with this modern research, this insight into inference has been around a while. There is writing in the Talmud in the 3rd to 4th century of the Common Era that essentially communicates the idea we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. A powerful, amazing insight long before brain science. And these are the kinds of things that we should have been paying attention to, but we have more reason to do so now. If all of this falls into place in the seconds or minute that it is available for it, it begins to be encoded. It begins to be laid down in short-term memory. Not very lasting, not very important until it goes further, but it has to go there before it gets anywhere else. But there's more. In order for that to then move into longer term storage, for us to have access to it for constructive use, we need a bunch of other things. And please be thinking of any curriculum over which you have control or any curriculum in which you're participating, and think about the translation of this into reality in your world for what comes in here. To really get in there, it has to be used over and over and over and over again, many, many times. After it has been used a while, been repeated, reflected on, it's been applied, and it's familiar, and this is true for both verbal memory and procedural or performance memory, then actually doing it some more becomes a little less important, because just rehearsing it in our brains, just thinking about it, turns out to have as much value effect in leading to more long-term memory. And some of you may know that a lot of advanced athletic coaches will now ask their performers, their athletes, to engage in mental rehearsal, to think through what they're going to do and how they're going to do it, because it's so important. Think of medical education and these requirements and how much of this we make available to our students and residents. Opportunities to repeat important things over and over. Encouragement to reflect, to apply, to repeat, and time in which to do it. Unrushed time, something that we, of course, have in abundance in medicine. But there's more. It turns out we now have some very interesting evidence that a good night's sleep and regular exercise aren't just luxuries for entertainment. As you may know, it started with some research with rodents. They learned too, and their brains have been studied too. And the first clues were with rodents, where an activity like solution of a maze problem learned during the day could be followed with imaging to see which pathways in their brain were being laid down while doing that learning. And to most everybody's amazement, if they had a good night's sleep, they retraced that same pathway not a few times, not a few dozen times, thousands of times in the course of a good night's sleep during deep sleep. And, of course, that's something we make sure our residents all have. But we now have confirmation that, growing confirmation, it's still early, this is emerging science, but it looks like the same thing happens in the human brain, this recursive revisiting of learning during deep sleep. But it gets more interesting, and that is, exercise turns out to be powerfully important. And I suppose thinking in evolutionary terms, it's not surprising. The average human being for millions of years walked or ran 12 miles a day or more. Exercise was what kept them alive, getting food and not becoming food. And this is part of who we are. And you know this research is being taken seriously when a corporation starts to make a big investment related to that. The Steelcase Company, one of the largest office furniture manufacturing companies in the world, and I don't know if the light here will wash it out, but there's going to be a very short video for a moment. This is being integrated into offices in various parts of the world because there is evidence that workers who do some exercise intermittently throughout their workday actually perform more effectively, more efficiently, and leave work happier than those who sit sedentary all day at their workstations. So the walk station may be a term that you will be hearing more of in the near future. But just getting back to this, there's one other biggie, really big piece, that we have not given enough attention to, and that is the powerful contribution or detraction that comes from the emotional experience of during learning. Emotions turn out to be a necessary component of effective learning. People learn best when they have a positive and fairly deep emotional attachment to what's happening, where it's emotionally important to them. And this is why some of us argue for the importance of what is sometimes called a sense of ownership, a caring about the material. It's not just my teacher wants me to do it, so I'll do it. It's because this is interesting. I care about it. It's going to help me in my career, or it's going to help me with my research or whatever. That emotional overlay turns out to be vitally important in learning, but there is a flip side. The emotional impact can be a serious detraction under many circumstances. A teacher who is somewhere along the continuum from harsh, mean to abusive can create a serious impediment to learning. There is a facade of learning because people say, oh, I remember that teacher better than anybody. But what they remember is the defensive tactics they organized to keep as far away from that teacher as possible or to avoid ruffling that teacher's feathers. There's no evidence that it turns out to be helpful. And with that, our time is running low. And I just want to emphasize that all of this gets called in the literature consolidation when it happens properly. And consolidation needs to be reinforced. It doesn't go in and stay there. It has to be reinforced and reused. And this is why application, the use of information in practical ways, turns out to be very important. And I'm just going to end by a very quick summary of two rather than four, as was advertised, because I'd rather have a discussion, and if you're interested, we'll get to the one or both of the other two, but two transformations that I feel are absolutely vital in health professions education. Our educational system, not just in medicine, has been symbolically captured by that graphic of a lecture hall of a centuries ago. You can't see it very well in this light, but it doesn't matter because a modern lecture hall is not very different ultimately. There's one person conveying information that others are supposed to assimilate for later use. And that's a process that we now understand doesn't work. It really doesn't work. Learning doesn't happen in those kinds of classrooms. It happens afterwards. Students use that classroom to figure out what the teacher cares most about so they know what to study to please that teacher, not to improve their own performance. Things are changing. Fully 3 decades ago, a lot of medical schools and others started experimenting with what we have in the old picture of the use of a form of lecture response system, so-called clickers or other names, where a teacher asks a question to find out what the students understand, supposedly as a basis for what they next do. And we, of course, now are trying to be much more interactive in our classes. But I want to invite you to think about the fact that that pales completely against what we do in clinical medicine, and that should be our model. In clinical medicine, we are so respectful of human diversity that every new encounter with a client, in this case a patient, is a unique encounter where we respect the human diversity of expression of illness and personality and experience, that we do a one-to-one diagnostic workup. And it doesn't stop there. We keep being diagnostic all the way through our relationship because we know things change. While in education, we not only don't even bother with an original diagnostic workup, we don't do much adaptation along the way. And my summary of the currently available data convinces me that learners are more different from each other in the way they think and learn than patients are different from each other in the way their disease or other difficulty expresses itself. We need this kind of individuality in education. We have a long way to go. It's not going to happen next week or next year, but this is a direction in which some places are just starting to go. I offer to you as a place we must go. And then to go to our second major transformation needed, that I'm going to tell you another brief autobiographical story, and then we'll end this segment. And many decades ago, in one of my several futile efforts to become an adequate tennis player, I went away to a tennis camp, a three-day intensive experience with a world-class coach who was going to work with our little group. And he came out the first day, all of us very eager, and said, "Welcome, folks. Glad you're here. I've got some bad news. You all came here to learn to play tennis. Not a single one of you will learn to play tennis in this 3 days." Of course, we all started to calculate how much our new clothes cost and our tennis racket. And he laughed and he said, "Nobody can learn to play tennis in a weekend. If you're serious about being a tennis player, you'll be learning it for the rest of your life. It's something that will keep you humble as long as you live. We can't teach you how to play tennis. We can teach you how to learn tennis. That we can do in 3 days. And what we're going to do in these 3 days together is do our best to implant in your heads the kinds of questions we hope you'll carry around the rest of your life, because we can't be there with you the rest of your life. You have to be your own coach. And you are a successful coach when you're asking appropriate questions continuously. Is my eye on the ball? Am I getting into position? Am I bringing my arm back far enough? Am I following through? Am I seeing where the ball goes?" And hundreds of others that did get implanted in my head, even though it's a long time since I played tennis. And that kind of fostering self-assessment, self-coaching, I want to offer to you as the foundation of mature learning. And we're doing some of it. We have teachers who are not only asking questions of students, we're asking students to express their questions. But I think we have a long way to go. I sometimes like to summarize the stages of maturity of education from the centuries in which all we did was conveyed information to the last few decades, where certainly in medicine, we've been doing a lot of asking of questions of students. The whole problem-based learning movement and case-based learning movement has been, in large part, our asking questions of students and students of each other. And I would offer phase three of maturation as educators is when we're doing a lot of inviting questions. And it's through inviting questions that a lot of important things start to happen. We transpose the learning experience. It becomes the basis for constructive reflection. People who are accustomed to asking questions engage in a task, see a patient, talk to others, and they're always thinking of questions like, "Am I paying attention? Am I understanding what's being said? Am I in touch with my own feelings? Do they tell me anything about the relationship between us? Am I perceiving some subtle cues that I may miss if I'm not paying close enough attention?" And a cascade of others that are part of the foundation of learning from experience. It's through that reflection, that kind of question asking, that experience is not just a passing event, it really becomes a learning event. And it's really the foundation of lifelong learning, which is what we have to assure happens for all our graduates, because they're going to have hopefully a long professional life, and we're not going to be there to help them. They have to do it themselves. So it needs to be part of all their experience, I would offer. And I'm going to pause at this point and ask how I've confused you, how I've intrigued you, what questions you have, and any thoughts you have about this material. And let me know, if you would, is this fresh to you? Is this repetitive? Is this very familiar or different? Please let me know what you think. Yes, please.
I'm not sure it's what you want to hear, but in a long life, I've never heard a more brilliant presentation in the way it was presented and the material. And I thank you very, very much. It
was You're not sure I'd want to hear that. Thank you. That's beautiful. Thank you. Did we get that on camera?
I wanted to do a bit of reinforcing. Have you any recommended reading?
Oh, no.
The same sort of material that you have been putting to us.
Unfortunately, I don't have a lot to recommend at this point because there's so little available, but I have a few things I'd like to recommend that is reading, and there are a few of us that we're trying to make other things available beyond reading, but there's not a lot. I don't know if this is horribly self-inflating, but I think I'm one of the fairly few people in the world of medical education who has had a very deep concern about the educational process, but also happens to have a biological background, and in my case, some neurological and psychiatric background, not as a patient, but as a clinician. I'm trying to pull some things together that I haven't seen pulled together quite in the same way anywhere else, and if there is some, I'd really like to know about it. But there are two books I want to recommend to you, and let me bring them up here. This is a very interesting book. It actually came out first in 2008 in hardcover. It's now available in softcover. It's also available as an Audible book. It's available on the Kindle. It's available in many ways. John Medina is a fascinating character who has been working in brain science in a somewhat indirect way, mainly in genetic work, but Medina took on the task of trying to bring us up to date on what brain research is teaching us. And he decided to set out to do a book that would only have in it peer-reviewed research that has been successfully replicated. So there are thousands of studies summarized in here, but you can really feel comfortable that this is work that is going through the test of good science. And it's not for medical education specifically or even university education. It's more for teaching and learning at the general level, but if you're willing to extrapolate from what he presents, I think you'll find that one of the richest sources currently available. One other source I'd like to bring to your attention is a little bit older, but still new enough. Daniel Schachter was chair of psychology at Harvard for a fair number of years. He's done a lot of brain research directly. He's had personal experience with it. And in this book, he picks out seven failings of human memory as his way of introducing us to the way the brain works. I think you'll find both books very accessible. They were written for the general public, so they are not the kind of book you would find listed in most course listings in universities, because most of us are too smug to make a general audience book available, and yet I consider them much better than anything I've seen in the professional literature, and it saves you a lot of slogging, because this pulls together hundreds or thousands of small studies on very particular details and puts them together in an absorbable way. So I hope you find those useful. Yes, please, Dale.
I agree with Dr. Beard. I thought it was terrific until you came to your last slide.
And this one?
I want to challenge you to comment on it a little bit, because, and I'll give you two contexts to answer that. One is working more and more in groups and teams.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the literature in behavioral change, self-assessment isn't very effective without something else. and that is some external input cue. I mean, that's why great pianists do long periods of going and spending time with people. And certainly the work by our friend, that we're all both getting older in Florida, who's done a lot of this work, has suggested why that's so important.
Yeah.
So I'd like you, would you like to qualify self-assessment a little bit more? Because I'm going to suggest it's not quite that simple. The principle is working.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That is one of a long list I could give you of things I failed to include in this abbreviated presentation, and that's a very helpful clarification. Self-assessment can't grow in isolation. The very essence of being a beginner is that we are incompetent to assess our own performance. That's what makes us a beginner. We don't know what we need. But it turns out we don't know what we need throughout our performance, throughout life. As some of you heard me say this morning, the top performers in the world in identifiable professions like, let's say, being a tennis player, or being a violinist, or being a pianist, or being an actor, those at the very top of the world all have coaches. They all depend on others to give them feedback, because even when we're at the top of not only our game, but the world's game, we still have blind spots. And we still have incomplete understandings, not only of what possible problems or difficulties we have, but what our strengths are. A lot of us fail to perceive some of our strengths that deserve to be built upon and expanded. So thank you. That's a very important qualification. And in no way was I suggesting that you go to medical school for a 3-day weekend and become a self-assessor and go out to practice. Jane.
You might want to expand on the giving feedback on self-assessment.
Thank you. Jane and I have done a lot of teaching together, and I really depend on her to fill in quite a few of the voids in what I do, and I hope it goes the other way around occasionally. But what she's reminding me of is that a big problem we've had working with faculty, helping them understand both the importance of feedback and how to comfortably give feedback, is how many people have grown up either unable to be direct with people about their performance, feeling awkward about it, they don't want to insult people, they don't want to hurt people, or they don't want to give too much good feedback. There is a deep tradition in some cultures that people will get blown heads, they will get too full of themselves if you say anything positive to them. So people in those cultures almost never get positive feedback from anybody. One of the things that people complain about most, though, is they don't know how to point out what's wrong in a comfortable, effective way. And one of the things we found over decades now and have tried to use and people have found helpful is shifting the onus from me giving primary feedback on performance to encouraging self-assessment, and then my feedback being on the effectiveness of the self-assessment rather than on the performance, so that what we are doing with learners is encouraging them to start to be as candid as possible. And sometimes the hardest thing to do is to get them in front of us to say that they did something well, because they're embarrassed. That's improper. They're ashamed of saying they did something well. And the first thing a professional will do is tell you what they did well. They're not ashamed of that. They're proud of it. But they'll also tell you with equal candor what isn't going well or what they didn't do well today. So our job, when we shift our feedback from feedback on, let's say, how they did an interview as a form of performance, if we shift it from commenting on the interview to a posture where we have our own observations about how they did the interview, but we use it instead to comment on their feedback. And in the overwhelming majority of instances, and we've done a lot of this, we're talking about many hundreds of experiences at least, the learner will say, you know, I think I missed something she was, my patient was trying to tell me. I was so preoccupied with my next question that I think I missed some important things she was trying to tell me. And then instead of having to say, you know, you missed some important things, we say, good for you. That was terrific that you noticed that. That's a big step toward becoming a mature professional. And all of a sudden, I'm the learner's advocate, and they're eager to work with me instead of frightened to work with me. It's a complete transformation of the learning experience. Thank you for reminding me, Jane. Yes, please.
I'm so glad you mentioned about exercise and good sleep. I'm a semi-retired pediatrician, and I found that with the luxury I can join a health club, yes, my learning process seems to improve. And so, and also, I heard that like there are teachers in inner city who help like attention deficit learning disability children, and with increase the supplemental exercise program in between their lesson, their function much better. So can you elaborate on the association between...
Could you all hear this comment? That's wonderful. Tell me if you can't. I'll be glad to try and summarize. Repeat. This pediatrician who is semi-retired was glad that I talked about sleep and exercise as important, and she's saying that now that she has some time in her life, since she is semi-retired, she goes to the health club, she's finding her learning is actually improving, and that she's heard that in some schools there are teachers working with some children with attention deficit disorder and other learning difficulties where exercise is turning out to be helpful. Is that a fair summary? Thank you. The brain is still working. There are schools now. In fact, Jane's sister lives in a neighborhood where the schools have treadmills, like you saw in that little still case video I showed you, where kids are using treadmills intermittently during class. It's in the classroom. And they have documented rising scores, disappearance of behavioral problems, a variety of transformations in the classroom associated with the availability of exercise. All you have to do is find yourself a young child who hasn't yet been damaged by some of our traditional parenting practices or traditional schooling, and watch how long they sit still.
Especially a male.
Well, I can show you a video of one of our female grandchildren. She's all over the place. And it's not because she has any kind of functional or other disorder. She's a healthy child, and she has to move. That's our heritage as a species. And if sitting in rows in classes, please understand that didn't come from research or careful thought. That was the arrival of the Industrial Revolution, where the heads of corporations wanted to get good assembly line workers, and they convinced the schools that you will prepare people to be good assembly line workers by teaching them to follow orders and to obey. And teaching has been, and still is, an issue of control more than it is of empowerment. And we have a little work left to do. Yes, please.
What would be your ideal model of a first-year medical school setup?
That's an interesting and maybe tricky question, because I have gone through that question in my own head many, many times for many years, and you're not going to like the first step of the process. My ideal first year of medical school would be to go to work in a healthcare facility doing a variety of jobs that have nothing to do with exams, tests, or anything. It would be beginning to get the flavor of this profession that you or your parents decided you should be in, and before you subject yourself to years of slogging and all that, make it an informed decision. Make it a decision that you can have passion around, because you've been working in a doctor's office for a while, in an emergency room for a while, on a ward for a while, you've gotten a feel for what it's like day to day, what kinds of decisions are being made, and you're being helped to ask questions during this time of, why do you do that? And is there another way? And where would I fit in? At what stage of my career? And gradually, going into medicine would be an informed choice rather than kind of all my friends are doing it, so I guess I should. And I happen to think being a clinician, nurse, doctor, a good clinician requires some personal social maturity. It's not just something that's based on passing a few exams on paper. It's emerging as a human being who has experience with life, who understands loss from a personal point of view, who can sit and relate to someone coming to them for help, not just filling out a form for presenting symptoms and findings, but connecting with this human being. Where do they live? What is the context of their lives that's shaping who they are and how they interpret their illness and what it means to them, so that I, as a helpful professional, can begin to respond in a way that is really adapted to that person, not just to some formula I picked up in class. So that, in other words, the first year wouldn't be in school at all. And maybe not the second year either. And when students came to school, for me, the ideal would be that the school will have made very clear to themselves first and then to the general public what they care about. What kind of doctors are they hoping to produce? What will be their characteristics? And they will be able to demonstrate experiences, role models, circumstances that really coalesce to move people in that direction. You know, almost every school in the United States has, we're going to produce humane, caring, scientifically founded physicians, and then do nothing to support any one of those. We have to have some evidence that there's a coherent culture and set of experiences that help people move in that direction, so that by time someone chooses to go to that school, it's a doubly informed decision. It's informed in the sense of they know what they want, and they know that this is an institution that might have a chance of giving it to them, rather than, I hate to say it, a huge proportion of entering medical students in the medical schools I look at are not mature enough yet to be health professionals. They are insufficiently experienced in the hurly-burly of real life. And so that may not be the answer you're looking for, but that's my best shot in a short time. Please.
Time for just one more question.
Time for just one more question. And no answer.
You said invite questions.
I don't even know if this is a question or a response to that. Seeing students through the years, I disagree with the maturity of the students. I must say, I find that actually it's my colleagues, and actually the number of years doesn't add up to numbers of experience. So that there's a lot of unlearning that goes on. And the ability to do introspection, to have emotional intelligence, those are not necessarily acquired solely with age, or necessarily even with experience, the same experience over and over. And some of the students seem to be more in touch with their own feelings, thoughts, and relationships. And I don't know. I don't know if it really is that emotional maturity thing. I'm not sure about it.
Well, thank you. That's a very helpful comment. There's actually a modest amount of systematic research to support what you've just said. The evidence of the deterioration, the degradation of the human qualities of young people after coming into medical school and progressing through the system. In other words, we kick the humanity out of a lot of them through the way we treat them. And that doesn't take away, though, from the possibility that they could be even more mature and even more experienced in life when they enter and go even further if the system supported them appropriately. But it's a very important reminder. Thank you very much. And with that, I guess we're done. Thank you.
So interestingly enough, as Beth, as you asked your question about Hill's idea of the first year of medical school, we are having a strategic planning retreat this evening that looks at the process of the strategic planning for our medical school. And two of the participants said, well, can Hill not come to the retreat? And he is. And that's why we have shortened this round by 5 minutes, because at 6:15 I have to take Hill to the retreat. So I want to make sure for those of you who came mostly to wine and chat with Hill that we have time for that. But I think you very much addressed many of the questions that we are looking at in our various design groups moving forward. And on behalf of all of us, I would like to thank you for your articulate, comprehensive presentation and for really modeling the two transformations that you want us to consider. So I have several things. One, as a thank you, is a little memento of McGill, your alma mater.
Okay.
And it really is wonderful to welcome you back to McGill. The other is that, as some of you may know, today's lecture was sponsored first by the Dr. Martin A. Enten Endowment in Medical Education. And I think any of you who knew Martin would agree that he would have absolutely loved this lecture and would have at least had 6 questions for you. We wouldn't have had to invite him to ask a question because he would have been intrigued from the outset. The other is that this lecture has been partially sponsored by the Royal College in support of continuing professional development here at McGill. So I would like to present you with this certificate from the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada as a way of saying thank you as well. And I think Deanna, our official photographer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Quebec, we kiss on 2 cheeks, in Holland, 3, and I don't know any other countries for you.
I don't have many more than that.
With that, I really would like to invite all of you to join us for a vin d'honneur and for you to continue asking your questions. I don't think we at McGill ever have problems with inviting questions or receiving questions. Thank you to all of you, and please join us for a glass of wine.
Thank you so much. Cheers.